Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The baseball talent pipeline that ran from Miami to Detroit this week has many hot stove watchers wondering whether the Yankees and the Red Sox could be 2008 also-rans. Ahead on Only a Game, Hot Stove League hijinks, also a look back at the 1990 Tyson-Douglas fight, and an outraged youth hockey coach dresses down a puckish artist for undressing two hockey legends. Also ahead, so, you want to buy an English soccer team?
The great joke is that this will be the only club where the manager can turn around and blame the fans if the team lose. You get all these chants when the manager's rubbish, and this time it will be chants about how rubbish we are. The fans, you know, sack the fans and things like that.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Once upon a time in Florida, there was a baseball team that impersonated a roller coaster. The team is the Florida Marlins, who no longer employ former All-Star pitcher Dontrell Willis or slugging third baseman Miguel Cabrera, now members of the Detroit Tigers. If you recognize the names of anyone currently employed by the Marlins, you probably need to get out more. Joining me now to discuss the most recent transactions in which the Marlins have been involved is Greg Cody, who writes about the team for the Miami Herald. Greg, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
The Marlins won the World Series in 1997, and the team was almost immediately dismantled. They won again in 2003. Is dismantling part two pretty much complete?
It is complete now, yes. Cabrera and Willis were the last remnants from the 2003 championships. They've officially purged, as they normally do. It's a weird cycle down here, but it's something the fans sadly have become accustomed to.
Well, critics of the Marlins said that the team's owner had bought the World Series back in 97, stocking the roster with players who were essentially short-term rentals. Is that the way this club has always done business?
Not so much. That was a peculiar situation back then. The owner was different. The World Series they won in 2003 was closer to homegrown. A lot of their trades for young players and a lot of their farm system people sort of grew up and blossomed together, and they sort of earned that World Series and then sadly did the same thing and sort of sold off that team piecemeal.
I understand that attendance at Marlins games might be charitably characterized as disappointing, but how gruesome are the numbers?
Well, I mean, they're last in the league in attendance. I think their average last year was around 13,000. The numbers aren't good, and there's no way to sugarcoat that. The frustration for a fan down here is that just when you begin to love a player, just when you begin to really get behind a player and think of him as yours, they go and trade him. And now you look at the Marlins roster, their best player right now is Hanley Ramirez, and a Marlin fan has to lament the very strong likelihood that in another 2 or 3 years, when Hanley Ramirez gets good enough to have a high contract, that he too will be traded.
So Marlin fans, as far as you can tell, aren't exactly kind of around to the point where they're ready to welcome all the new talent and hope for the best. They're probably still sort of wishing they could have held on some of those guys.
Oh, yeah. I mean, fans like to cheer for who they're accustomed to and who they're used to. And Miguel Cabrera is a guy anybody who follows baseball would predict that he's going to be a Hall of Fame player. And they let him go in his prime. Dontrell Willis is the most popular player on the team and the winningest pitcher in franchise history, still only 25 years old. They let him go in his prime. So it's very frustrating down here to be a Marlins fan and see a franchise that's too cheap to hold on to its best players.
Greg Cody covers the Florida Marlins for the Miami Herald. Greg, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Anytime.
In 2003, while the Florida Marlins were winning the World Series, the Detroit Tigers lost 119 games. The last two players from that 2003 World Championship team in Miami are now Tigers, and the Tigers are suddenly great, at least on paper. Joining me on the line is Detroit Free Press sports columnist Michael Rosenberg. Michael, did anyone outside the Tigers' front office foresee such a dramatic move this offseason?
I don't think people inside the Tigers front office foresaw such a dramatic move until about 24 hours before they made it when they were contacted by the Marlins. And nobody thought that they were going to be allowed to go to $128 million in payroll.
Mm-hmm.
They were pleased with their team. They were sort of in that mix of teams that knew going into next season that they would have a shot. If they were going to do anything, I think they would have added relief pitching. And Mike Ilitch, the owner, said, "Hey, I hear Miguel Cabrera's out there. What can we do?" Next thing they knew, they had an offer on the table, and they liked it.
The Tigers were already a very good team. They were terrific last year until the last 6 or 7 weeks. They didn't really need to make this trade.
No, they didn't. And, you know, it's funny. They would have clearly been the best team in the National League before this trade, but unfortunately their application to switch leagues was denied, so they're stuck there with the Red Sox and the Yankees and the Indians. They didn't need to do this to contend, but it sure helps.
You mentioned Tigers owner Mike Ilitch. He has had a reputation of being one of the cheapest owners in baseball. The 2003 team had a payroll of just under $60 million. With the trade, the Tigers are going to be paying out about $130 million in 2008. Has Ilitch been secretly replaced by a drunken sailor on perpetual shore leave?
You know, sometimes you cover sports and you come upon an owner whose attitude is, you know what, I'm old and I want to win. So it's weird. When he first bought the team, he had the highest payroll in baseball, and it was very poorly distributed among players who were not that good. And he lost a bunch of money, and he got hurt by it, and he said, "I'm not going to keep doing this, throwing money at the problem." Then they went 43-119, and he thought, "Well, I've got to do something. This is too embarrassing." Signed Pudge Rodriguez. That worked out very well the first year or two. Signed Maglio Ordonez, and has started to figure out, you know what, we have a chance here if we increase payroll and make the right moves. I think he's got more faith in Dave Dombrowski than he ever had in Randy Smith, which may be related to the fact that Dave actually knows how to do the job.
The Tigers did give up several promising prospects in order to acquire Willis and Cabrera. Do the fans care about the team losing that young talent, or are they too delirious with what they've acquired to worry about that?
They don't care now, but if those guys turn out to be great, they'll want everyone fired. That's the general feeling. I think it's reasonable, don't you?
No, it kind of comes with the job, doesn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. I think the difference is here is that they've got two guys who are stars. Certainly Cabrera's a star, and they are young. I mean, they're only, what, 4 or 5 years older than the prospects they traded. So purely from a baseball standpoint, as good as Cameron Maven may be, and a lot of people think he's going to be one of the great ones, is he really going to be better than Miguel Cabrera? That's kind of hard to argue. Mm. So it's really hard to argue against this one. I think if they had traded for a third baseman, a starting pitcher who were 31 and 32, people would be very upset. But these guys are in their mid-20s, so it's kind of hard to argue.
Also, I have to sort of wonder if fans in Detroit are going to mind rooting for the New York Yankees of the upper Midwest.
Well, I think they're okay with it now. They did it all right in hockey for all those years when the Red Wings were spending three times as much as everyone else. So as long as the Yankees are spending more, they can sleep at night figuring, hey, somebody else is buying a championship more than we are.
Michael Rosenberg is a sports columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Michael, thank you again.
Always a pleasure.
The new Cleveland Browns have been to the NFL playoffs just once in 9 years. There's certainly no confusing them with the old Browns, who played in Cleveland for 50 years, became an NFL powerhouse during the 50s and the 60s, and departed after the 1995 season to become the Baltimore Ravens. But as Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports from Cleveland, this year's team looks as if it could be a contender.
Although the Browns trail AFC North Division leader Pittsburgh by 2 games, their 7-5 record has them vying with 8-4 Jacksonville and 7-5 Tennessee for the 2 AFC wildcard berths. That's a big improvement over their 4-12 finish last year and 16-32 record since 2004. And fourth-year head coach Romeo Crennel can thank a newly designed Browns offense, ranked 3rd in the AFC behind mighty New England and Indianapolis, for saving his job. Reporter Tony Grossi covers the Browns for the Cleveland Plain Dealer.
There's no doubt that Romeo was on everyone's list of coaches on the hot seat as this season began. Especially during training camp and preseason, the offense was horrible. It just didn't look like anyone was catching on to it. And then as soon as they made the quarterback switch after the first week, this thing just took off, and it's not supposed to happen that fast.
Since taking over the starting quarterback spot, Derek Anderson has passed for 24 touchdowns and better than 3,000 yards, mainly to wideout Braylon Edwards, who's accounted for more than 1,000 receiving yards and 12 touchdown catches, both career highs. Oft-injured tight end Kellen Winslow is healthy again and having his best season with 900 receiving yards and 5 touchdowns. Grossi sees another dimension to Anderson and company.
He's got this height, 6'6". That way he can see over a lot of what's going on in front of him. Not all quarterbacks can do that. Plus his receivers are all tall. They're almost like playing on a different plane than the defense.
As Cleveland's passing game has reached new heights, it's opened up the field for veteran running back and first-year Brown Jamal Lewis. Lewis piled up 216 yards against divisional rival Cincinnati earlier this year and is on pace for his 6,000-yard season.
Just having great receivers and a good quarterback throwing the ball downfield kind of opens things up and makes defenses play us more honest than I've been used to in the past, which is usually 8-9 man fronts or whatever, and guys coming in to stop the run. But, you know, with this offense, you can't really do that.
The Browns' defense is another story. Cleveland ranks dead last in the NFL and has allowed 390 yards a game, an irony that isn't lost on Coach Crennel, who helped build a championship-caliber defense for the New England Patriots.
Well, the thing that concerns me is that we're not good, okay? We're not good enough. When you look at the stats, we can't stop the run. We don't rush the passer efficiently enough. And so within the remaining games, we're going to work to try to get better, to get guys to play technique longer, to be in position better. And if we can do some of those things, then we'll be better.
That would be much appreciated by the Cleveland fans, adds the Plain Dealer's Grossi, who says the team's travails have put this longtime football town to the test, especially as basketball's Cavaliers and baseball's Indians have gone deep into the postseason.
This city is just so hungry for the team to be good. And so this season came at the right time because I think the Browns were losing fans. The product out there was just not exciting. And the Browns are lucky that their fans are so passionate that they've waited this long. There are kids who grew up here who are wondering, well, let me get this straight. Why am I supposed to love this team so much other than the fact that I'm from Cleveland, you know?
The Browns couldn't answer that question very well in their 27-21 loss Sunday at Arizona. Even the offense struggled as quarterback Anderson turned the ball over 3 times. Lewis ran for just 68 yards, even though he sees a silver lining in defeat.
We kind of needed that loss, and you don't need a loss, but, you know, you needed it kind of just to put everything back in perspective and, you know, just getting things together and preparing, you know, for the run that we need to make for these next 4 weeks.
The Browns' remaining 4 opponents have managed a combined winning percentage of just .333, so Cleveland could have the inside track in their run to the NFL postseason. The Browns play the 3-9 Jets in New Jersey tomorrow. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Cleveland.
Cleveland, city of light, city of magic. Cleveland, city of light, you're calling me. Cleveland, even now I can remember. Call the Cuyahoga River, go smoking. Do my dreams burn on Big River?
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Anticipation of freezing rain and snow caused the postponement of the annual Polar Bear Plunge in Zorinsky Lake in Omaha, Nebraska. The event, which raises money for the Special Olympics, was to have taken place yesterday afternoon, but the organizers were worried about ice and snow. Well, right, you wouldn't want an event that requires people to dive into a freezing lake to be spoiled by ice and snow. But seriously, folks, Wendy Jackson, a spokesperson with the Special Olympics of Nebraska, said she was concerned for the safety of people who'd be driving to the event, which makes a certain amount of sense. More sense, certainly, than diving into a lake in Nebraska in December. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the naked truth about some former Boston Bruins stars. But first, on February 11th, 1990, Mike Tyson, the heavyweight champion of the world when the day began, lost his title to a heretofore apparently unexceptional fighter named James Buster Douglas. In his new book, The Last Great Fight, Joe Layden maintains that the fight, which he considers to be the greatest upset in boxing history, changed forever the lives of both Tyson and Douglas. Joe Layden joins me now from the studios of WAMC in Albany, New York. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Mike Tyson was an overwhelming favorite when he fought Buster Douglas. In fact, some people who knew a good deal about boxing regarded Tyson as all but invincible. Was that how Tyson saw himself?
Well, at that point in his career, I think he probably did. He was very young. He was the rare fighter who, at that point, at least in his career, really enjoyed fighting for the sake of fighting. Kevin Rooney, one of his former trainers, said to me, "We fought for the glory of fighting. It was all about just the fight." An interesting thing that Kevin said to me is that all fighters eventually lose their taste for fighting. It's not the most pleasant occupation, obviously, and eventually as you get older and you experience enough pain, you have enough of it and you fight just for the money. At that point, I don't think there's any question that Tyson was fighting because he was a boxing fan, something of a boxing scholar, and it defined him, and he liked the way that it defined him.
Well, he was a boxing fan and a boxing scholar and the champion of the world, but he came into the fight in less than optimal shape.
That's correct. And, you know, revisionist history is interesting, but he had started to slip in the year prior to that fight. He hadn't trained as hard. He hadn't put as much time in the gym as he had in the previous 4 years. In general, he didn't want to be in Tokyo preparing for that fight against Buster Douglas. I still think he was a tremendous fighter, a tremendous physical specimen, and I think that James Douglas is often not given enough credit for the performance that he turned in that night. I think it was at least as much about the way Douglas fought and prepared as it was about the way Tyson didn't prepare.
Well, Buster Douglas was in the best shape of his life on that particular night, and one of the stories in the book recounts how a couple of the guys working in Tyson's corner learned several days before the fight just what great shape Douglas was in because they were running at the same time he was.
That's correct. Douglas was a notoriously lazy fighter and notoriously lazy trainer. Everyone within boxing sort of knew of his talent. They knew of his lineage. His father was a terrific middleweight fighter in the 60s and 70s. Everyone knew that he had the ability to be a great heavyweight, but had rarely displayed that ability in the ring. But he had trained very hard for the fight against Tyson, and he had trained very hard in the weeks and months leading up to it. And yes, Tyson's handlers were out one day going for a run, and they spotted Douglas up ahead of them, decided to sort of pressure him a little bit. So they tried to catch up. And Douglas, when he realized that someone was catching up to him, basically just shifted into another gear and pulled away from them. And that is not something anyone would ever have expected of James Douglas.
You maintain that the Tyson-Douglas fight was, quote, the most memorable night that boxing has ever known. But what do you say to the devil's advocate argument that says in terms of the impact that a heavyweight championship fight has had on the public at large, Lewis Schmeling II, Dempsey Tunney, the Ollie Frazier fights, all may have been more significant and more memorable?
There are different ways to measure these things, I think. That statement couldn't have been made 15 years ago, maybe not even 10 years ago. The more time that passes between Tyson Douglas, I think the more you can make the case that it's one of the most significant fights, if not the most significant fight, to the sport that we've ever seen. I think that Tyson was the last professional boxer, certainly the last heavyweight, who really galvanized the sport, who transcended the sport, and made it popular, or at least made people who weren't boxing fans aware of what was going on in boxing. And the beginning of the end for him was the loss to Douglas. And as Tyson sort of drifted out of the mainstream and became what he became, which was more of a tabloid figure than an athlete, I think boxing lost its fan base. It's a niche sport for the most part now. I'm not saying that it had the same sociological implications that Lewis and Schmeling did. I don't think you could make that argument. But in terms of its impact on the sport of boxing, I don't think there's any question that it's one of the most important fights in history.
Well, at one point in The Last Great Fight, you write of Tyson's attempted comeback after he got out of prison in 1995 that, quote, a gentler, more refined Tyson with a predilection for amicability would impede the fighter's natural and irrefutably useful, albeit sometimes troubling, inclination toward violent antisocial behavior. When not troubling, I mean, given that you're talking about his irrefutable inclination toward violent antisocial behavior.
Well, boxing is a, if you've known, boxing in my in my view, boxers are among the most interesting of athletes. Violence and pain is a fundamental part of their daily lives. And boxing is a tricky sport in terms of if we really psychoanalyze ourselves and why we like it, if we like it, and a lot of people don't, of course. What do we really want to see? And at some point, Tyson crossed the line into an acceptable, interesting athlete who was capable of tremendous physical prowess and violence in the ring into someone whose behavior outside the ring was so distasteful that he had no fans at all.
Well, and not only distasteful, I mean, we're talking about assault and rape. It was illegal, and he went to jail for it.
Oh, of course. And I you know, I think if you read the book, obviously I'm not an apologist for Mike Tyson or any of his behavior. And what I didn't want to do in the book, however, was just paint him with a broad brush as a total pariah who's not worthy of our investigation and our consideration. He's too important a figure in sports history to do that, I think, and it would have been too easy for me as a writer to just take that approach and say Buster Douglas was the hero, Tyson was the villain, and that's the sum total of the story. I think that when he came out of prison, there was hope in some circles that he had been reformed, that he learned how to channel his aggression in a proper way, and that it wouldn't sort of leak out into the public realm when he finished fighting, too. Obviously, that turned out not to be the case. And on top of that, he had lost his desire to be a fighter.
The focus of your book is on the two fighters, obviously, but you also have a good deal to say about promoter Don King. You write at one point, regardless of which fighter wore the crown, a piece of it would always belong to Don King. With regard to Tyson and Douglas, was that literally true?
Well, in terms of promotional contracts, King typically had promotional deals with fighters all over the heavyweight ring, all over boxing, actually. So, yes, he did have a promotional deal with James Douglas, even if Tyson had, even after that fight, he was going to have a promotional deal with either fighter. And that's why Douglas tried to break that promotional deal based on King's actions after the Tyson fight in Tokyo.
Buster Douglas almost ate himself to death just a few years after he won the heavyweight championship. He got up to 400 pounds, and he nearly died of complications from diabetes. And then he staged a kind of a lackluster and ill-fated comeback. Mike Tyson's most notorious post-Douglas fight found him biting off his opponent's ear. Tyson has been convicted and jailed for various crimes, including rape and assault. Only Don King seems to be thriving. Do you regard that circumstance as an indictment of boxing?
I think it's easy to indict boxing. There are a lot of nefarious characters in boxing, and King is certainly at the very top of the list. There is no shortage of tragic figures in boxing, no shortage of people who at one point climbed to the very top of the sport and somehow at the end of their careers ended up with no money, in bad health, their personal lives a wreck. I'm not sure why that is, except possibly that it's the type of sport that really exacts a toll on a person, on a human being, in every way imaginable. I think that going into the ring is different than standing outside the ring and sort of pulling the puppet strings, which is what King has done his whole life. And he knows how to do that very well. Douglas, I will say, though, he did go through a very difficult time, but, you know, he made a lot of money for one title defense against Evander Holyfield. He seems to have kept most of that money. He's healthy now. He does not appear to be a guy who spent a lot of time in the ring. He's sharp. He's funny. He's ingratiating. And seems to be pretty happy. I look at him as a person who had sort of a tragic arc in this story, but who came out okay.
The contention that Douglas Tyson was the last great fight, your contention in the title of the book, assumes that there won't be any more great fights. Why not?
I don't know that there will be. There may be great fights, and certainly I've been challenged on this by boxing people, by real hardcore boxing insiders. Although generally speaking, they seem to love the book too. I think that there may indeed be good fights, and there may be really entertaining fights between people who are technically proficient and really good at what they do. But will there ever be a fight of tremendous significance? I think that's really unlikely. I just don't see boxing being more than a niche sport at any time in the foreseeable future. There are no heavyweights out there who really would galvanize an audience. And, you know, the old saying is that as the heavyweight division goes, so goes boxing. And it's been a long time since we've had a heavyweight who really captured the public's imagination. For better or worse, Tyson did that.
Joe Layden is the author of The Last Great Fight, published by St. Martin's Press. He joined me from the studios of WAMC in Albany, New York. Joe, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill, for having me on the show.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. An exhibition of paintings at the Deitch Gallery in New York, featuring several life-size images of former Boston Bruins stars Bobby Orr and Derek Sanderson, has caused quite a stir. In some of the paintings, Orr and Sanderson, who did not pose for the artist, are wearing no clothes. Here to comment on the exhibit, which runs through December 15th, is George Carter of Carver, Massachusetts. He coaches mites, midgets, and neutrinos, as well as peewees. George, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bob. I've been coaching youth hockey in New England since Ike was elected president the first time. And even though my wife Doris voted for that egghead Stevenson, we definitely agree on one thing. We don't know nothing about that, but we know what we like. And what we like is good, hard-hitting hockey. So anyways, it's a freezing cold night a couple of weeks ago. I'm up in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan there. That's in Canada. I'm staying at the Bullwinkle Lodge, and then the phone rings. It's Doris. George, she says, and she's all excited, you got to come down to New York as fast as you can because there's an art show with oil painting pictures of the great number four, Bobby Orr, and Derek the Turk Sanderson. So I get on the first bus I can, and I met Doris in New York. We find the art gallery way downtown where the beatniks live in New York. The guard leads us into this room because he tells us that's where the Bruins are hanging. And hanging is just the word. Because what do I see but Bobby Orr, number four, God bless him, and Derek Sanderson, bigger than life. They was even bigger than that big, scary-looking 6-foot-9-inch guy who's now on the Bruins. I can't remember his name. Bob, maybe you can help me out here.
I can't help you. Just let it roll.
Don't matter. Anyways. And they was completely nude. Now, to me, this crosses the blue line and the red line of good taste. And what made it even worse is that the so-called artist, a guy named Kurt Kalper, is from Massachusetts, and he grew up idolizing the Bruins. But what bugs me most is, what if one of my little polywogs, or even one of the older kids, like the elves or the gnomes, walked in on Bobby and the Turks' nude paintings? I say this Mr. Smart Guy artist deserves at least a 20-game misconduct penalty for desecrating a national monument, number four, God bless him, Bobby Orr, and somebody also at a high stick, this so-called artiste, then check him face first into the boards.
Whoa, George,
the way the Turk used to
George,
do to the Blackhawks' Keith Magnuson.
You can't
before
really mean
raking his eyes with the back of his gloves.
That
was hockey. That was hard-hitting hockey. That's the kind
of
hockey I want to see today.
It's
so namby-pamby nowadays.
That this guy has. I mean, Derek Sanderson said the nude portrait was fine by him.
He was always an expeditionist. As far as I'm concerned, I got one last thing to say to you kids out there, you young hockey players. Keep fighting. And always remember to put on that uniform, especially your pants, before you hit the ice or anything else.
George Carter coaches mites, squirts, peewees, bedbugs, germs, munchkins, dwarves, Lilliputians, amoebas, gnats, microbes, and no-see-ums, and his wife Doris drives the team bus. Thanks, George.
Bob, I think I need a cold compress or an even colder Carling's Agansett. My blood pressure's going right off the charts here.
Can we get some ice
a
in
nude
here?
Picture of Bobby Orr.
You're listening to Only a Game. In my conversation with Tim Kirkjian on last week's program, Tim wondered whether the people at HBO planning the movie about Barry Bonds would be able to find someone big enough for the title role. Peter Witkoff, who hears Only a Game on WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, suggests Samuel L. Jackson or Ving Rhames, whom he describes as good actors who look good with shaved heads. That discussion with Tim inspired Craig Kenworthy, who listens to the Only a Game podcast, to suggest some titles for that upcoming movie. How about Curb Your Enthusiasm, he wrote, in which a clueless Giants fan offends everyone by claiming Bonds is being discriminated against because he's left-handed? Or The Sopranos, in which a trainer must decide whether to inform on his client and his therapist is no help at all? Alan Wells, who hears the program on KCUR in Kansas City, had a comment on my doggerel regarding the futures of Barry Bonds and Pete Rose, two record holders who may never enter the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. Maybe the Hall of Fame people should put bronze statues of Rose and Bonds on the grounds looking in toward the hall, noting their records and why they will always be looking in, he wrote. Mr. Wells, a graduate of the University of Missouri, was upset that last week's program contained a story about the football team at the University of Hawaii rather than his beloved Tigers. Why, Mr. Littlefield, why, he asked, and then he wrote, "See tear falling from my right eye." Charlie Pierce's comment on the cheap shots delivered by various members of the Philadelphia Flyers this season irked Steve Maggi, who hears Only a Game on KUT in Austin, Texas. "As a Flyers fan, I'm not surprised to hear the whining from a Bruins supporter," he wrote. "I always expect sour grapes from Boston." And he's right. When the Red Sox aren't winning the World Series, the Patriots aren't going undefeated, the Revolution aren't in the MLS Finals, and the Celtics don't have the best record in the NBA, sour grapes is about all we've got here in Boston. The old NFL slogan on any given Sunday surfaced last week in our story about parody in the NFL. Mike Quinn, who hears the program on WCPN in Cleveland, was thereby reminded of a Plain Dealer sports writer who explained an especially bad Browns season some decades ago by saying, "They just had too many given Sundays." On any given Sunday or Saturday or Monday through Friday, you can let us know what you think by contacting us through the website, onlyagame.org. Our address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at breakthroughcollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up soon on Only a Game, the story of Ebbsfleet United, the English soccer team ready to welcome you as a co-owner. How rare is the opportunity? Rare, my friend. You have no chance to gain an ownership share of Forest Green Rovers, Woking, Farsley Celtic, or any of the other teams against which Ebbsfleet United competes. You want a piece of Aldershot Town, Droylsden, Norwich Victoria, or Histon? Forget it, mate. Burton Albion, Rushton and Diamonds, and Kidderminster Harriers are also out of play for you, straight off the table, closed for that sort of business, aren't they? Now, are you interested in acquiring a stake in Ebbsfleet? I thought as much. Stay tuned. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the thrill of team ownership made available to the masses. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Barry Bonds pleaded not guilty to obstruction of justice and four counts of perjury in San Francisco yesterday, and that's pretty much what everybody expected, right?
Yes, and now we are off on our next celebrity death watch trial, although I still suspect this one may not get to a jury.
Barry Bonds' agent, Jeff Boris, announced this week that his client wants to play in 2008. So you want to pull out your driver now, because I don't think I can tee that one up any higher for you.
Yes, and I would like to play for the Celtics starting on January 1st.
That sounds
and
good.
I would like to have a lovely Snow White unicorn to ride to the ball games with. But guess what? It ain't going to happen.
Well, the great thing about it is if he's playing, he can't be in jail. And so that would work out just fine for him. On Thursday, Jay Gibbons and Jose Guillen were suspended for 15 games apiece for violating baseball's drug policy. I guess Major League Baseball is warming up for the Mitchell Report.
That's exactly what it is. These are the canaries in the coal mine.
There are also people who have been linked to human growth hormones who apparently will not be punished, because when they were doing human growth hormones, it was not against the rules to do human growth hormones, which I think is going to be one of the great fault lines in the report when we finally see it, because it is designed to be the equivalent of a legislative oversight report, which is to give out, lay out the facts and put out a plan for the future. You're going to see history divided into people who took this stuff before it was against the rules of baseball and people who took it afterwards.
Charlie, is it fair to say that there has been enough off-season reshuffling to greatly improve the Detroit Tigers?
Well, I think Jim Leland's got to be happy as a clam. I mean, they picked up Edgar Renteria and Miguel Cabrera, and you know, they didn't give up any players who played for them at the beginning of last year. They gave up six members of the farm team, which is, of course, 50% of why you have a farm system in the first place. They were lucky. I mean, unlike the extended negotiations about Johan Santana, the Tigers were dealing with a team in Florida, which is essentially running a chop shop at this point, and were able to get anything they wanted.
The Dodgers are betting a little over $32 million that a mediocre season Andrew Jones just had with Atlanta was a fluke. Good bet?
Yeah, anybody who thought Scott Boras had lost his fastball because of what happened with Alex Rodriguez in New York has to rethink that a little bit. He managed to get $36.2 million out of the Dodgers for Andrew Jones, who is very clearly on the wrong side of the hill.
One of the most brutal assaults ever committed during an NHL game happened back in 2004 when Todd Bertuzzi mugged Steve Moore. We talked about that, of course, at the time. Were you surprised at the news this week that Bertuzzi might have just been following orders?
No, I'm not. This has been suspected of the former coach of the Vancouver Canucks, Mark Crawford, ever since it happened. I think that this is a very, very interesting twist in a story that we, Frank, quite honestly thought had gone away. This is a very serious charge, and if it's true, not only should Crawford pay the price, but the Vancouver Canucks should, too.
The charge here, basically, is the coach said, go get him.
Right. I mean, just following orders is never an excuse, but this is an explanation that could have ramifications up and down that franchise.
Charlie, we have perhaps paid too little attention to the Heisman Trophy competition this year, but now it's time.
Hold on.
Yeah, strike the pose, please. Thank you very much. Florida quarterback Tim Tebow, Arkansas running back Darren McFadden, Missouri quarterback Chase Daniel, and Hawaii quarterback Colt Brennan were named the finalists this week, and you've been striking the pose. Please relax. It's making me a little nervous. I don't want you to get too tired, but have you got a pick?
I do. I would vote for Darren McFadden of Arkansas. I would have voted for him last year. I vote for him this year. I'm impressed by Tim Tebow, but I think McFadden has actually been a better player this year. Chase Daniel from Missouri is there as sort of an indication of how crazy the season was. He came on very late in the year. Unfortunately, he's not even the best Heisman candidate on his team. That would be freshman Jeremy Maclin. And, you know, Colt Brennan in Hawaii, I'm sorry, they lose in the grounds of Charleston Southern, which is actually a team they played this year. If you're going to play in the Bay State League, you're going to get caught for that sooner or later. And I'm glad he got invited. I think he's going to be a pretty good pro, but he's got no more business winning the Heisman Trophy than I do.
Tomorrow, it's the Pittsburgh Steelers' turn to try to prevent New England Patriots from going undefeated. Pittsburgh defensive back Anthony Smith has guaranteed, this week he did it, guaranteed that the Steelers would win. Is he channeling Joe Namath circa 1969 or just channeling a river of idiocy?
When are they going to learn? The one thing the Patriots don't need is a reason to beat you up. And if you don't give it to them, they're going to invent one anyway. So make them go to all the effort of making one up. Don't hand them on a silver platter. I thought Hines Ward was going to throw this guy out a window when I saw the general reactions to the comments. What are the odds that the New England Patriots go deep on Anthony Smith with Randy Moss within the first three plays of the game?
Congress has been conducting hearings into the circumstances of disabled former NFL players, and this week the House Judiciary Committee learned that the league doesn't know how many players have been forced to leave the game because of injuries. Does this strike you as, remarkable, if not completely unbelievable?
Well, I think that, you know, the House Oversight Committees on many levels are pretty used after 7 years of this to disappearing evidence. But you know something? They hate disappearing evidence. And they hate being told that people of whom they're already suspicious can't find what they need. This was a very bad development for the NFL.
The NBA has begun requiring coaches to wear microphones this week. Players may soon begin doing so as well. Is this an attempt to improve broadcast production values or knee-jerk surveillance in the wake of the Tim Donaghy scandal?
I think it's a guarantee that the NBA is going to be on cable television for the foreseeable future.
Either that or a lot of bleeps.
Because I will guarantee you a lot of these players are neither going to remember nor care that they're wearing a microphone. And Kevin Garnett, to name only one, will treat America to a great variety of the English language's wonderful panoply of obscenity.
And finally, Charlie, we have a new world record to celebrate. A team of welders and mechanics in Germany has created the heaviest motorcycle ever. It's over 17 feet long, it weighs almost 2 tons, and it's powered by an engine that was built for a Russian tank.
That's not the most impressive thing. The most important thing is that it's 7 feet 6 inches tall.
Yes, it's very
long. Only Manute Bol could start this thing. What do? Get a ladder, climb on it and sit down, and then have one of the guys like the old biplanes bottom and go, contact, who hits the lever?
I want to be there when it happens, but I'm also delighted by the name that its creators have given this monster.
Yes, and I am more than dazed and confused by a 7-foot-6-inch tall motorcycle. It is called Led Zeppelin.
Charlie Pierce's protestations notwithstanding, he is never dazed and almost never confused. And he writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
I want to see the guy jump this thing.
The Green Bay Packers are the only team in the NFL owned by fans. According to the team's website, 112,015 people own shares of the Packers. At their annual meeting each July, the owners elect a board of directors, which elects the people who actually run the club. Owners do not vote on the head coach or which players the team will acquire or which players will start. That would be ridiculous. Or would it? Only a Game's Karen Given has the story of a football club in England that's looking to take the Packers model to the next level.
Hello, I'm Rory Edwards, club secretary. Welcome to Stonebridge Road, home of Ebbsfleet United. Here's our club tour.
Ebbsfleet United is a mid-level team in the English soccer hierarchy. Less than 1,000 fans attend home games. They play such teams as the Kidderminster Harriers and Aldershot Town. In an online video, future fans get their first view of the locker room.
Here are the showers, where after the match the players come in and get rid of all the mud and grime. This may look like a wheelie bin, but believe you me, it's not. It doubles up as our ice bath.
If all goes according to plan, in a few weeks, Ebbsfleet United, a club with a history dating back to 1890, will be owned by the 25,000 members of My Football Club, a website dating back to April of 2007. Josh Friedman is a lawyer working in Boston. Although he's happy to be interviewed as a My Football Club member, he doesn't necessarily want to advertise how much time he's spent on the MyFC message boards. And he's not alone.
There's 4,370 different topics, and then there's been more than 112,000 different individual posts, and this is just since August. I mean, just for me, I have almost 1,400 posts.
Just you?
Just me.
We probably shouldn't tell your employer that.
Yeah, or my friends. And the sad thing is, I'm not even in the top five.
Friedman first read about My Football Club in The Economist in June. He paid his £35 when memberships were made available in August. And like every other owner, he has an equal vote in decisions from player acquisitions to marketing strategies. He was intrigued by the website's slogan, "Own the club, pick the team." But don't expect him to be debating the benefits of the 5-3-2 offense, at least not right away.
I'm a Red Sox fan. I'm a Patriots fan. I gotta admit, I wasn't a fan of the New England Revolution. What I did find interesting was this idea that we could vote not just on the starting lineup, which I think is the big selling point to people who are big soccer fans, but also the idea, what are we gonna sell in the team shop?
When My Football Club announced their agreement in principle to buy Ebbsfleet, critics went crazy. Choosing a starting lineup based on an internet vote was called the most ridiculous idea in the history of the game. It was considered an insult for 25,000 outsiders to suddenly have more power than fans who had supported the team for generations. One writer went as far as to suggest that My Football Club should be renamed Your Football Club Screwed. Friedman wasn't sure what to expect when he traveled to Stonebridge Road, 25 miles outside of London, for the first Ebbsfleet home game after the announcement.
And as you might be able to hear from my voice, I was hooting and hollering. for Ebbs Fleet United. I learned what you say when they're doing well, which is up the fleet. And the local people there couldn't have been more welcoming. I had some trepidation. You know, who are all these people on the internet? But when they saw that we were real people and not just a bunch of pimply kids playing on PlayStation, I think they felt a lot better about it.
Hi, welcome to Ebbs Fleet United's training ground. We're here for the first bit of footage that we've shot for the website since the announcement of the deal in principle. We're going to have a look at the lads in training and then try and grab a word with Liam Daish.
While my football club is more real than a PlayStation game, there's no doubt that the internet is integral to its success. In a web video, Tim Glynn-Jones interviews Ebbs Fleet manager Liam Daish, who will become head coach should the sale go through. In a message to his future employers, Daish seems to be fine with his demotion.
Yeah, I'd just like to welcome. I'm glad that they've chosen us. We're a hard-working bunch of individuals here, and we're going to give it the best shot we can, and I'd just like to say thanks for being involved, and I'm looking forward to the future working with you guys and girls, and between us I'm sure we'll get a winning formula and a successful team.
Although the website has only been online for 8 months, former soccer journalist Will Brooks has been knocking around the idea for years. Along the way, most people said he was crazy. His friend, Tim Glynn-Jones, was no exception.
I've always thought he was crazy, and I think he still is, but he's always been one of those people who likes to ask why and why not, and to challenge the status quo and find alternatives that might be better. But no, I thought it had potential, because you just know when you hear the idea of fans actually getting involved in picking the team that football supporters are going to love that.
My football club takes that idea as far as they can. On the website, members are invited to buy the club T-shirt, which is described as classic owner-manager loungewear, and the polo shirt, ideal for the golf course or when socializing with owners of other football clubs. And unlike Packers fans, who could consider themselves owners, my football club members will be responsible for every decision the team makes.
The great joke is that this will be the only club where the manager can turn around and blame the fans if the team lose. You know, you get all these chants when the manager's rubbish, and this time it will be chants about how rubbish we are, the fans, sack the fans and things like that.
Unlike in American sports, where a minor league team will always be a minor league team, in European soccer, clubs can move up. For the past 6 seasons, Ebbs Fleet has played at the top division of non-league football. Each season, the best 2 teams are promoted to the Football League 4th Division. Even with 25,000 ready-made fans and the influx of cash they bring, it would be unheard of for Ebbs Fleet to climb the ladder to the division where teams like Manchester United and Arsenal play. But that doesn't stop owners like Glynn-Jones from dreaming.
Our hope for the team is to go all the way to the Premiership and into the Champions League and win the Champions League. The sky's the limit. There's no end to it. It's going to be a snowball effect. And once it starts gaining success, more people will come on board, more money will come in, we'll buy better players, we'll rise up the leagues. In sort of time-honoured way, we'll be putting in an injection of, a million, maybe a million plus each season, which is unheard of for a lot of clubs in lower divisions, and will enable them to climb up the tables.
I'm certainly looking forward to the experiment, but like most people, I'm just waiting for it to fail.
Tom Dart writes about soccer for the Times of London. He worries that fans on the internet, spread out over 70 countries, most of whom can't even watch games on television, won't be able to fully grasp the intricacies of a club like Ebbs Fleet.
They get relatively little publicity and media coverage, so the vast majority of these members will know absolutely nothing about the club, may not even know that it's, where it is in the country, certainly wouldn't be able to name the top scorer or the goalkeeper or the coach. It's bad enough having the 20,000 people who think they can be football managers on the basis of, playing computer game simulations. But for those people then to do this without having adequate knowledge would be even worse.
My football club has a plan to solve that problem, of course. They're hoping to make game footage available on their website, along with video from training and weekly updates and recommendations from the coaches and trainers. But Dart is still skeptical.
I suppose it's possible that if this does go spectacularly well, then given that a lot of football clubs in England are in debt, the boards will look at this and say, this is a way to offer success and get ourselves out of a loss-making business. But if this fails, I don't see any other clubs trying it again anytime soon.
Some people aren't waiting to see if the experiment works. Recently, Biggleswade United, another non-league club, offered 5,000 ownership positions for the bargain basement price of £23.50. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Football, football, I like football, and I'll travel anywhere to see my favorite team. Football, football, I like football, and I'll travel anywhere to see my favorite team. I've been to Aston Villa, Arsenal, Aldershot, Barnsley, Barrow, Burnley, Birmingham City, Bournemouth, Brentford, Brighton, Bury, Blackburn, Bolton, Wanderers, Blackpool, Bristol City, Rovers.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Vince Fairchild and Julian Saparidi and from Stacey Perry at WAMC in Albany. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to learn more about the last great fight or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Ebbsfleet United shareholder Josh Friedman, who has been to the team's concession stand and sees the need for vast improvement.
Their hamburgers are terrifying. So, I that's one of the things I'm looking forward to.
It sounds like the league in which Ebbsfleet plays could benefit from the designated burger rule. Bring in some of those high-priced American models. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
You're working in Torquay, Tottenham, Tranmere, West Ham, Wolverhampton, West Bromwich, Albion, Watford, Warsaw, Wrexham, that's all. I'll travel anywhere to see my favourite team. Football, football.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.